Dr. Koontz, rather than beginning with a standard question this week, there's enough going on worth just kind of talking about, and you'll have plenty to say on all of it, I'm sure. I don't want to come in from the side and not be able to connect it, especially given the size of the events that have happened to my community in Rockford, Illinois, which has made national and even some international news in this last week due to initially a stabbing of an 18-year-old black male who goes to the worst high school in town, works at Walmart on, you know, Monday evenings because he's got his act together. And he's killed in cold blood, stalked even by a white male from outside Rockford, somewhere in Illinois, Cambia, Illinois. White male outside Rockford who tried to check himself into two different psychiatric wards the same day before going to Walmart, saying, "Help me," and was turned away. Goes to Walmart, paces the store, hurling slurs at black individuals, and finally takes two knives off the shelf and just kills this guy from behind. Several others were involved in trying to stop it, but I think this kid's the only one that's injured. So that was a pretty big deal. And the fact that it made, you know, news with a stabbing in London, kind of in the same headline, London and Rockford, like that doesn't happen very often. It'd be Chicago usually. And the fallout, of course, there's a internet online rag in Atlanta that picks up on this and wants to use it to race bait. And so, you know, I'm here the last couple of days, largely praying that my city, which doesn't seem to have a lot of white-black animosity, like they've tried to get stuff going downtown in the summer as like a protest against a black man who was murdered years ago by the police. And it might have been really bad. I'm not sure. I don't know that much, but they got like 20 white people stopping traffic, you know, on Friday nights. You know, there isn't a race war about to break out in Rockford, but like this is the kind of thing that enough internet and phone can make you copycat. And wouldn't you know, there's a copycat murder yesterday, more 4 killed, 7 more injured, all with a knife, South Rockford. And for a solid 24 hours, you know, no pictures, which told me he probably wasn't white. And he was not. He's not. It's a completely different community. It's Spanish on Spanish. Little girl, girlfriend, grandma, mailman. I mean, it's brutal. On Twitter, someone says, yeah, California, they're dealing with this. You just don't hear about it. So maybe this is more normal than I think. But it all kind of came down to one big moment. There's some, you know, it's Monday, Thursday. I'm going to have church anyway, twice. Like they're having like rally church, you know, in the UCC style out there today to, you know, pray for it. Yeah. And Governor Pritzker's like, my condolences, you know, and I'm like, you know, if concealed carry were a thing, I just think this doesn't happen very often. That's my thought. You have someone get shot. Sometimes nobody gets stabbed. That's just kind of my thought as a citizen, as a pastor. I want peace in my neighborhood, and I'm tired of the stories from far away making young men go insane. And you look at both of these killers, and you know, Dr. Koontz, you know, the psychiatric drugs aren't exactly helping those who cause these kind of actions. You can maybe talk more than that, but I think it does cross-reference really well with a commentary by 3-time Super Bowl champ Harrison Butker on lack of fatherhood being the actual problem that really is driving all of this. So from there, wherever you want to go.
Yeah, there's at least two different strains there that I want to take a look at. And one is the notion of race baiting, or basically the fact that your story from Rockford is being picked up internationally and paired with stabbings in London tells you that you're dealing with London-like problems, which I think in this case would include stabbing, that does occur in jurisdictions where carrying a gun is difficult or impossible. So That's why you have the nature of that particular attack. But I think what is more important here is that you really only hear stories like this So you only hear white on black. You don't usually hear much about black on black. Those shootings generally don't have a racial identifier on them.
Because can I interrupt real quick yeah. on that? And is there, I was talking with my family about this, because there is black on black death that happens in Rockford with some regularity. Sure. We're not a murder capital, but we're also not unviolent. The thing is, they don't stab each other.
You know? Yeah, well, I mean, stabbing in the United States is also, it is, you know, honestly vanishingly rare.
Yes.
Relative to other forms of murder.
Yes. Yes.
And it seems like this guy in the Walmart did it because it was available, right? It was right there, I guess. I don't know. I don't know all the details of where he was hanging out in the store. He also killed an employee, which is like, I'm also not sure about that reason. The story that you sent me portrays him as if he is solely racially focused and just looking for the right black person to harm. Something you will notice is that that happens in white on black reporting. It does not happen in black on black. We don't get a narration of what the guy looked like on video before he tried to kill people. And you don't get national stories about black on white. You just don't. And whatever the incidence of these things is, you can go look them up yourself and figure it out. Whatever the incidence of these things is, the purpose of stories like this is to incite hatred specifically of white people. And that's when you get liberal Protestant churches turning out. That's the ultimate point of this. There's no, because the actual strain here and the thing that links it with the other story that you discussed, where the suspect is named Christian Soto and is, you know, Mexican or something like that. The thing that links Christian Soto to this guy, Carter, the knife attacker in Walmart, is that they both either profess themselves to be crazy, that's Carter, or they look obviously crazy.
Yes, without question.
In the case of Soto, right? Like, he just doesn't look right. And the way that that gets dealt with for I think, rather obvious political reasons having to do with constituencies, patronage, et cetera, that we talked about in relationship to immigration too, is to incite hatred of, in this case, particularly whites. And then you'll notice that other cases that don't have a clear narrative of both white agency, but also white rage, white anger, do not get racialized in the telling, or they're not even told, right? They're not even told, even where you could make a similar case that, okay, these people were killed because they were white. This little boy was beaten to death in his, you know, in his own yard in North Carolina a couple years ago.
I saw one 2 weeks ago or a week ago.
Right.
It's in the same context of this happening. I had just seen, you know, it's a local story from somewhere in the South, and it was a black and white, and it seemed to be racially motivated. You know, I only see it because it's on Twitter. It's not on mainstream. It's never going to make mainstream.
Right. Yeah. And so, and what it's going to do on Twitter is going to have the same effect that mainstream media does, but just in a different direction. Right. So, I mean, it's not like these stories don't enrage people of various races. But I think what you have to understand when you see a story like this is not only is there the immediate problem and whether that's going to get solved. And if it's white on black or white on whatever, then you can tack on a bunch of civil rights charges eventually if you want to, particularly to a white on black case like the prison guards down in Mississippi that apparently abused two black inmates that were just sent to jail for whatever, multiple decades. The way that this doesn't get handled is in terms of looking at any of these groups as humans. And I think what I mean by that is when you're using race as the lens, it's not that I don't think that that's like fake, right? Like, I believe people do hurt each other and even kill each other because they belong to different groups. That applies to race, usually in America. It applies to ethnicity in other places. It applies to religion in other places. Okay. That happens. The solution, however, that is not particularly a solution of how do I weaponize this for political purposes, would have to do with recognizing how a person gets to a point, because you have to ask yourself, like, does it have to be like this? So you said generally race relations in Rockford are generally peaceful. And there are lots of places in the United States that you could say race relations are generally peaceful, or that they were more peaceful before 2012, or that they were better in the 1980s, or they were worse in whatever decade, right? You could, that's fine, right? You have to ask yourself, well, why? And why is it like this now, right? So why now is somebody who's crazy, his impulse is, if this is in fact true in the case of Carter, who knows, right? A court of law has to prove that he is, despite cameras, he's allegedly innocent until proven guilty. That's not how the media works, but he is innocent until proven guilty. You have to ask yourself, like, well, how could this be better? Because if you want a long-lasting solution that doesn't involve the extermination or expulsion of this other group, you have to figure out how to live with this other group, whatever the other group is, racially, ethnically, religiously, culturally. And if you're going to do that, then in order to live with other people, as anyone who lives with anyone else knows, you do have to set aside anger at various times or deal with it, however justified it may be. You can't live in constantly acting out your anger. And what I think is interesting about everything from Twitter to mainstream media with their various niches and their channels that is that what happens is that you have an incessant amount of fodder for anger, right?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
You
have
you can go find it anytime you want, right? So just use search terms from, you could say white on black, black on white, you know, black crime, right? You can go look all this stuff up. And that's not going to provide you with a solution necessarily, but it will provide you with fodder for anger for whatever it is that you wanted to be angry about. And the stories that you're reading may be true and they may be untrue. This story from Newsbreak that you sent me, I mean, it convicts Carter of not just being crazy, right? Not just stabbing a guy, but irrationally hating everyone of African descent, obviously on camera somehow, right? And so if you want to find something to make you angry, you can find it. And I don't really know how you maintain a country that way.
Well, let me suggest for a moment that anger is in fact the hook of most sales pitches on the internet. If it's not some sort of like health gimmick, what the news is trying to get you to click on is anger. It has to be. And it turns to despair because when anger cannot be used, you've got to depress it.
Yeah.
You might feel depressed after that.
Right.
And, you know, and lead into despair. So I think anger is a big part of what our current media zeitgeist, for lack of a prepared term, is using to sell things.
So no, that's right. And when Texas is, you know, think about banning social media for, what is it, kids under 13?
Good idea.
I think that the age limit, I mean, the number there should be 100. Like if you make it to, if you can make it to 100, then you get to go on social media because you probably, have learned enough that you can use it responsibly and realize how little it's doing for anybody. So if you're 98, you know, you're not quite there yet. Is that I think adults think that they somehow escape trends that are obviously visible and studied, and at this point almost everybody knows about them in teenagers. So in teenagers, you know, the advent of smartphones causes measurable spikes in all kinds of psychiatric dysfunction, all kinds of misery, all kinds even of criminal behavior, right? It makes it easier. It provides fodder for those things. But we don't think about that in terms of adults. Like, I mean, I don't hear anybody suggesting that, you know, was the incidence of lung cancer actually worse than what we are putting ourselves through with smartphones? Like, should we move to ban smartphones the way that we ban cigarettes? And maybe that seems really intrusive to people. I don't have in my political philosophy much of a libertarian bone. So I'm more interested in the question of what this is doing to the general populace rather than how this is going to be misused. There are other considerations, obviously. My instincts are not infallible.
Well, but, if LCMS constitutions like all have a part in them that says no unorthodox books or materials shall be used. I mean, really, like extrapolate from that. The idea wasn't then you went home and did whatever you want, right? Like these books were the ones you took home and that's all you ever saw was the idea. And that might have been overreach. Of course, in a printing press time, it was pretty normal.
It was normal for insider
groups to write their own stuff. And now, again, is how do you put the genie back in the bottle a little bit is the question that I think we would have to ask. And I'm not opposed at all to your semi-monarchical concept of some just rule of law and no one gets to argue because we know it's better and we have to stop the evil. But who does that and when and where in our current system is what people argue about on Discord.
But yeah, I mean, Discord. Smartphone adoption is obviously way beyond anything that cigarettes ever touched.
But I had to throw into, if you're going to go that way, sugar. Sugar is so much more of a destructive force right now. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. They're like, they pair with each other, though, and they're working together to destroy minds and livers.
Yeah, right. And so this is not something we're talking about because obviously the provision of this conduit even to, I mean, what do you get when you arrive at our southern border, wherever it was in the world that you came from?
You often get a phone. Yeah, right.
And I mean, I've seen these phones because I see these people. They have nice phones, okay, that they probably didn't get somewhere in El Salvador, you know, or wherever they came through on their way here. So that conduit is really, really, really important. And we're talking about this on individual levels. I mean, I know plenty of people who on an individual level have gotten rid of their smartphone, but the idea that this would happen generally or that it would even be possible, because for a lot of us, it's necessary for work or it's at least necessary for the expectations that work has for us. So that, you know, you would be available, you would respond more or less instantly, right? So I'm not saying this like, here's my quick overnight solution, but the fact that we're not talking about it, even though, because you'd have to think about the alternatives here, right? Let's assume that a 28-year-old guy, I think that's how old the stabbing suspect is, that he doesn't, when were smartphones introduced, like 16 years ago? No, even farther, right? That he doesn't have for the past decade plus a phone. So that's going to go back for a 28-year-old back into high school. That he doesn't have any of that. And so now his understanding of how the world works is going to be derived mostly from what he can read or handle. And now he's going to have to figure out, what do I see around me? Who is dealing with me interpersonally? And once he realizes that, he's going to have to do his own thinking. Whereas when he's got a phone, he doesn't really have to do his own thinking because whatever he needs intellectually or whatever he might want to think about can be provided for him instantaneously anytime he wants. So then if you think about the specific issue of race relations, right, which is kind of an old term, that's back from the 60s, I guess. I'm dating myself. Is that he can read, and then he has to look at what's going on around him. And I'm not saying you look at what's going on around you and you never get angry. I'm saying that there is a vast difference in the incessant flow of rage-inducing things that you can find if you want to versus life where your experience is not that every person is either uniformly wonderful or uniformly horrible to you, even of another race, another religion, another whatever the dividing lines are where you live. And because of that, you have to find ways to get along with other people, because before the internet, practice of life is that you have to learn to get along with the people you live with. And if you don't, then you are in some kind of Yugoslavia situation where people that you have lived near for hundreds of years are now engaged in some kind of all-out war with you that has to sort itself out. That process that entered the American lexicon before widespread internet usage, which was Balkanization, is something that the internet makes infinitely expandable everywhere, even to places where, by virtue of how people live and how their neighborhoods are set up and everything, do you have to have contact with people who are hostile to you on an everyday basis? And think about what that's like, even if those people are racially identical to you or religiously identical to you. Do you want to live there? Well, no, of course you don't. So what if we're all being made hostile to each other all the time? And that gets talked about as, you know, they're trying to divide us. I think that religion, race, class, these naturally divide people. I don't think the media is creating division. The media is doing something with human difference that you don't have to do. That's what's going on. We are different from each other in many ways. That's okay. The question you have to ask yourself is, what am I going to do with that? And in a society of people who are almost uniformly becoming progressively more mentally ill by virtue of their smartphones every day, what's going to be done with that is that we are going to fall apart, right? And that's an awkward, delicate verb for a process that I see happening not only between people in terms of rage, but also inside of people in terms of just go find Christian Soto, suspect in Rockford, Illinois. Look at the guy's eyes.
Yeah.
People shouldn't look like that, you know?
No, the only place I've ever seen eyes like that is a crack addict, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, and demons, I would imagine, are not so far removed from that kind of a facial distortion.
Right.
Yeah. Being made hostile all the time by what we see without a understanding of it happening to us. First off, we don't even know we're being poisoned. And then without an antidote, without a remedy, without a physician that enables us to take practice and do something different. So you're recommending as perhaps a bitter pill, the absolute destruction of these things. I tried to get rid of mine. The last 3 years for me has been a try to be a Luddite and stay an LCMS pastor as far as you can, learn the ropes and come back as much as you have to. And I really tried to get rid of that smartphone. And what they really trap you into now is financial ties, insurance thing, all that kind of stuff. Banking is very much into it. It is the coin.
Yep.
As bits and whatnot continue to go. So anyway, from there, as you try to, you know, engage this impossible task, I had to decide that for the good of the next generation, I've got what I've got and I've got to teach them how to have something better. And for us in the family, and we can go this direction with the conversation, you know, we have very, very clear goals with media use in the family and limitations for people. And the mother of the family more or less avoids it. she just disdains it. She scoffs at it. And so, you know, the kids kind of pick up on that, yeah, you can listen to music, you know, but like, why don't you just listen to the birds? And not that we love music here. The fight to change that, the practice of technology in the household is one whole conversation. Where I kind of want to stick with right now, though, is if you're stuck in it and you can't do anything about it, you got to deal with the anger somehow. And that issue I did talk about, I think, a week ago, as most listeners would have heard it. And then there's a follow-up question that I think we can jump into some more of the idea here.
Sure.
So I'm going to read part of that follow-up question where Campbell says, I appreciate your commentary on anger not being sinful of itself, self. Excuse me. But it seems to me you made an error when your distinction between sinful and non-sinful anger was predicated on whether or not your anger was acted upon. Now, I don't know if that's quite what I said, but his point is very valid. It would have been better, so far as I know, to distinguish anger either as sinful or good, not by whether your anger is acted upon, but by whether or not it is just, and whether or not the actions which flow from it are just. And that'd be, of course, according to the word of God. I think we would both agree. This is not a distinction without a difference, because if one is angered for a just cause and fails to act for that just cause, and I completely agree with this, within whatever legitimate roles they have to deal with that situation, then the anger is not sinful, right? If you fail to act on your anger, and you're supposed to in God's sight, then you are sinning by not acting on your anger. This is his point, right? I continue with his words. But the inaction is sinful. To give an example, we don't need the example. I'm going to the bottom. If I misunderstood your point, some clarification would be appreciated. If I've struck on an important distinction, which I think I have, I think it would be good to clarify that point in future episodes. Thanks again for what you're doing. And on. So thank you, Campbell. I don't disagree with you at all. And I just think maybe you took something I said as wide as a little narrow. And that being then, I think the first step for most young men when they are trying to figure out how to deal with their depression, which is really a form of anger, is to learn how to be angry and not act on it. Like, they're not going to be able to do what you just said about distinguishing just and unjust anger until they've realized, I can feel this way for a while and I can think while I feel this way, right? And a lot of young men are just trapped in not allowing the feeling to exist. And then when it does exist, there is no thought. So I completely agree with you, though, at the end of it, like, the ideal virtuous man, right, is able to be just filled with rage. No one would know, except for that, if it's righteous, because it's true and good according to natural law and the revelation of the word of God, then he's going to do something about it, which is really what we're talking about here as an episode. That's why we're having this episode. Is I'm pretty pissed off. There's stabbings in my, like, not my neighborhood, but close enough now. And you know, this is without all the rest of it that's going on in the world right now. Will we have time today to talk about the Francis Scott Key Bridge? I don't know. So from there, Dr. Yeah. Reese, let's talk about anger.
Yeah, I think that your point about linking depression to anger is a good place to start, because that has to do with the way in which people do not have any kind of healthy or simple or natural looking flow of emotion. So if you can think about the difference in a stream when it runs wild versus when it is completely controlled or even dammed up entirely, that's because some kind of outside agency, almost always humans, you know, sometimes beavers, don't want it to work that way. And so they will willingly change it in order to get the flow to be what is more useful for their purposes. You have to realize that whether you're talking about smartphones specifically or more generally with the way that emotion is handled by our society, especially when people are constantly being entertained, so their emotions are incessantly manipulated, is that people, that is the reason why people behave not only violently, not only with rage, but just oddly altogether. Because the way that emotion is generally managed in a human society is through learned behavior concerning what to do when you meet somebody, what to do when you have a conflict with somebody, what to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those are the differences between cultures, but they're all dealing with the same basic issues of greeting and bidding goodbye and handling conflict and making small talk, or in some cultures, just not making small talk, or whatever the case may be. If your emotions have been primarily managed not by the people in front of you and not by your own reflection, but by media, then of course you are going to be extremely weird. You also will not be, and this is, I think, intentional, you will not be sympathetic or even aware of the emotions and the manners and the mores of your actual ancestors and your actual neighbors. You will be more like each other wherever you're from than you will be like anybody who is actually yours. So then you'll be more isolated. And the insight that depression is a refusal to have a certain kind of emotion, particularly in young men, of anger, is, I think, key, because you have to realize that your emotions are being managed in a certain way and that you don't have control over them. So it's not that emotion is in itself wonderful. In fact, for a lot of decision making, particularly, it's horrible. You have to learn to put it in its proper place, but you put it there. You have to put it there. You can't have someone else putting it there, because in young men, the way that your emotions are being managed is to make you unmasculine.
Correct. Amen. Right. Amen. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the reason that absence of feeling is supposed to be there in you is so that you are much, much more easily manageable, because the forms of life that are available to you are generally going to make you desperately unhappy if you actually have contact with your own emotion. And then you'll have to think, why am I unhappy? Right? Because it's not even a simple restlessness that would cause that caused young men to go to gold rushes or caused young men to want to go to war. It is basic functioning. Are you allowed to actually exist as a man in your workplace? Are you able to, is there anyone to become your wife? Like, natural urges in all men that are not, you know, just sheer restlessness or unusual amounts of energy. Can you actually live a life with these things? And because the answer to which you're being generally trained is no, you need to become the cog that we are making you into, then of course you're going to be unhappy. And so the best thing to manage your emotion, and this is why a flat affect, a certain sadness, a certain amount of self-loathing caused from pornography use is so important to the various forces that entertain and enslave you. That's why it matters so much. So when you come into contact with an actual, like, honest to goodness emotion in yourself that has some sort of positive force to it, this situation is wrong, I want to fix it, then that is shocking to you. It's also kind of hard for you to handle, because it's like you're, you know, 10 years old and you're behind the wheel of your dad's truck now. I mean, everybody's scared about what's going to happen next because you don't know how to drive this thing. And I think to realize that you have been stunted that way, and therefore to take time sort of becoming human is important, right? And there's nothing more popular. I mean, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about race relations and the usefulness to mainstream media, particularly of white people doing bad things. That's kind of the bad class here. Men is an even larger class of bad people.
We are the worst,
right,
literally.
Right. Because men are, you know, there are even more men than there are white people. Right. So that's an even larger class. And whatever race you are, whatever you are, if you are male, you are categorically bad. And the things that you think are categorically bad. So I have never found older people more dismissive than of men and boys. I mean, the things that they have said about the dysfunctions of young men shock me, because they would never say equally obvious things about women. They would never say it. Infinite grace is extended. The dysfunctions of young men, particularly their often obsessive anger that has to be sort of taken in hand and guided. Incredible impatience with young men. Incredible, right? The failings of older men, their greed, their, you know, disinterest in marital fidelity, you know, those are common problems, right? That could happen to anybody. The dysfunctions of young women, that could happen to anybody. You know, we need to, you know, kid gloves basically are used. Young men, no. How could you ever act like that? How could you ever think that? How could you ever? And when that occurs, you are not working towards a functional society. this is much more widespread than whatever the mainstream media is trying to do, or whatever, you know, a Twitter influencer is trying to do, because this is a basic dysfunction in everyone's home, is that the young man is not allowed to it, and therefore is not developing into a man. That process is just stopped, right? Arrested development, where you keep him kind of dependent and weird, particularly dependent on female or feminine being loose about where these adjectives go, feminine figures or feminine structures of how things work, where there's a lot of silence, there's a lot of silent pressure, things are not generally handled out loud, you are subordinated particularly to unspoken expectations. Systems like that they're not designed to allow, to enable young men to become men. And at that point, you're working with what is explicitly a matriarchal society. I mean, that's where we are. And there have been matriarchal societies. When we did the BAP episode, you know, the reason BAP used the term longhouse is because the Iroquois, especially in North America, were a matriarchal society. And the women governed often as what are called peace chiefs. So you can use men, but they're only useful in times of war. The men would be war chiefs. The women were very often, and this is very different from the Christian societies that replaced the Iroquois largely, which were patriarchal at that time. The women could often be peace chiefs. They were in charge, and they can send the young men to die. Of course, they themselves don't fight, but they can send the young men to die. So it doesn't mean that men are not useful. It means that men have to be subordinated. It's a matriarchal vision, and it operates in a manifold number of ways. The anger, for instance, that comes through your phone particularly, or that is engaged through your phone especially, is useful if it serves some larger purpose, if it can enable you to be entrapped by the FBI, or if it can enable you to become a, you know, whatever that is going to attack whatever other group. I mean, it's not that things that are unique to men or nearly unique, like violence, right or wrong, aren't useful, but it means that it will be channeled in certain ways that force is useful to somebody else. It's not you developing your capacity to manage anger. It's your anger being useful to somebody else, because the thing about not knowing how to handle your emotions is that you become someone else's pawn. Temptation works that way with demons generally. It also works that way with human agents who are themselves allied with demonic purposes. You become extremely useful to them. When you actually develop the capacity to manage your emotion, you are useful only to those whom you are serving in your family, in your whatever, right? You're useful in a positive way. When you can't manage yourself, you are extremely useful to people who want to use you. And that's where most of our guys are. That's probably where most of the men listening to this are.
Yeah, it's great stuff. When you say managing your emotions, given what you've taught me about the managerial revolution, can you give me a different word?
Yeah, sure. You could say governing. You could say ruling over. You know, this is kind of the power of. I mean, it's sort of an internet meme, but you know, I like to save this for, you know, not the first conversation I have with a young man, but if he does something that is good, I say, good job, King. You know, is that he feels like he is worthwhile, because it doesn't mean that everyone is meant to be in charge of some giant enterprise or is going to be fabulously wealthy or whatever his goal is. But every man is, and this is, you know, this goes back to your concealed carry thing. Every man is meant to be the defender of his own castle, even if his castle is a two-room log cabin. It's his. That's why it matters. And that's why you respect it, because it's his. men who have never been taught how to, have never learned how to govern themselves, have no pride. They, in a good way, right? They might have a ton of anger. They have no pride and they have no sense of joy in their lives. And so once something like that does happen for them, then I think they are, it is extremely powerful to them that they are able now to govern something about themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if it's just that they finally got a job, whatever it is, right? So that's why I you know, I mean, it's a little bit of a joke, but it's kind of not to call them king, you know, the day they got a job for the first time.
That's right. And
they're finally doing something productive, because now they don't have to be worthless. They don't have to be slaves, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The patriarch principle, as part of the Sons of Solomon discipline, sonsofsolomon.net, is an attempt to take everything you just said and summarize it so it can be seen that the role of the father is one of many roles. It's central in its typology. It shows us who God is, but it doesn't exist alone. It exists with many others. The role of the father in this existence with many others is both upward and downward. So the patriarch who is given to rule over those who are under him has to do so with a recognition that there will be those who are over him. And in those relationships that are created, then again, shown in the father and the son and so forth, yeah. We have not just a biblical salvation, right? But a natural law that we as men in an age of hyperfeminization, matrilineal decay unto, is it straight up matriarchy? I mean, I think the point is well made that we have a, not just a platform, a foundation
yeah.
that's built into us in our bones and the word affirms it. And we can go back to it, but it does involve reign, rule, governance. You could say kingdom, judgment, all these kinds of things that, again, in the Bible are prophecy even. You kind of mean the same thing at a certain point, which is the capacity to make justice in the face of great evil. With all that then,
yeah.
I want to also hat tip that the fruit of the Spirit includes self-control. And self-control, then, I think, is a lot of what this also, you know, kind of can be headed under, that we are being taught, we are being formed, we are being grown as out of control people.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and
totally.
This is to make a profit on us. We're a crop, you know, we're like a herd. And the Christian Holy Spirit given gift of self-control is worth asking for. And worth believing that we
yeah.
do in fact have.
Yeah. And I don't want to be heard to, you know, basically just play into a different set of marketing initiatives whereby being a man involves your truck being a certain, being in a truck at all times, the way not everybody was in, you know, 1955 when masculinity was probably doing a little bit better. Being in a truck and it being a certain distance off the ground and, you know, wearing certain t-shirts or having like a Civil War style beard or lots of things. You want to do all that, that's totally fine. But I think it's important to notice that masculinity is just another marketing ploy on some level for a lot of people. And that if the guy has a really impressive beard and, you know, a certain set of stickers on that truck that is a certain distance off the ground at the same time, which is grandpa didn't need to be a man. None of that.
Amen.
His grandpa, in fact, probably doesn't like that he has a beard, you know, and I think, but all of that is really, it is play acting.
Yeah, that's right.
On some level, if there is no self-control, it is play acting because you cannot govern yourself. You might be playing at being a, you know, in terms of, you know, Iroquois longhouses, you're a war chief, or you look like a war chief, or you act like you're a war chief, but you are simply extremely useful in that function to whatever other prerogatives. And this is why you can find those guys with those trucks, with those beards, with that set of niche interests. And the biggest of these is, of course, sports fandom. And at this point, sports betting. you are extremely useful because you don't govern yourself. You look really manly. You're not having a gender identity crisis, but you are extremely useful because you are a slave. You don't govern yourself. You're not in control of anything. All of that stuff might have been bought on credit for the sake of displaying a certain kind of manhood that will be washed away in a crisis or isn't even there at all. So this is where, you know, I mean, you might look really masculine. This is not play acting we're talking about. You might look really masculine. If you don't govern yourself, you're not in control of anything. You're not a man.
Yeah, like a city with broken walls is a man who cannot rule his own head, heart, and the rest of it. I want to stay with anger as much as we can. I want to drop a couple other pieces of news because, I mean, the Francis Scott Key Bridge was accidentally on purpose knocked down. It was all kinds of stuff. I think my understanding of the most reasonable explanation that does not involve foreign powers is that, you know, when you have no power and you drop anchor, it can make the ship do crazy stuff if it's going too fast. Obviously, it could become a lot worse if you want to imply that that was on purpose, right? And I'm not saying it was or it wasn't, although in this world right now, incompetence is on purpose and it's destroying us. And you can see that with the Mayo Clinic adopting DEI policy. I'll just read that they are looking to hire refugees, neurodivergent, single parents, blind, low vision, deaf, hard of hearing, Black, Hispanic, Asian, military veteran, elderly, LGBTQ, and justice impacted individuals at the Mayo Clinic, a place people travel from all over to go get standardized care. And they're changing their standards. So you might want to be aware of that if you live in Minnesota at all, because you get a lot of money from this place. And, or if you're trying to go there to get healed, you know, just pay attention. And then a little tiny tidbit, but not that tiny, you know, in U.S. law, informed consent is slowly vanishing. It's only upon things that they don't think will harm you right now. But that doesn't... When you get Nuremberg out of the way, things just go a different direction after that. But, and then, yeah, that's the Mayo Clinic. There we go. That's all. Okay. Oh, good news on the Francis Scott Key Bridge. I do want to say there was a guy wearing a white hat that day. There was a construction worker who stopped many cars from going onto the bridge so that the primary people who died were in fact construction workers and not citizens traveling at that time.
Right.
So beautiful act by a good man in the right place.
Let me do the Mayo thing before we, I want to end on the construction workers because I think that they link up better with what we've been saying the whole time. I mean, the Mayo thing links to our where we started, because the reason mainstream media does what it does with race and violence is because that is racially the most disfavored class is white. If you're up against a neurodivergent candidate for a job at Mayo and you're not neurodivergent, now you're disfavored, right? And we know how this works. And the accumulation of favored classes is the accumulation of recipients of political patronage. And that's how our regime operates at this point, right? It's not a truth-based regime. It's a group-based regime. So it doesn't matter whether you, who are a white female who's not autistic, would actually be a much better nurse than the neurodivergent Somali up against you for the same job. It doesn't, the focus there is not care or medicine.
No, I just don't see how the blind guy's going to do surgery. I can't see it.
Well, you know, that's your bigotry talking.
I guess,
you know,
so.
Right. And the difficulty here is that this is a really quick way to destroy a society, because you build a society accepting that there are objective truths outside of personal perception or, quote, lived experience, such as when bridge pillars get hit by container ships, they fall down. Yeah. Or, you know, so that is the way that you build a civilization, is by accepting objective realities and then finding a way to handle them, such as cancer at the Mayo Clinic, or whatever number of other things people fly from all over the world to Southeast Minnesota to be taken care of for, right? If you're going to now favor instead this group, that group, whatever, right? Then you're saying that matters more. The fact that the autistic Somali male nurse can have a job matters more than the care that could have been afforded by other job candidates who had more experience, who had, you know, a doctor of nursing practice or whatever, that were more qualified for what? For the job, for caring for patients, for medical research, whatever the issue was. Now we're favoring instead patronage to groups. That's because that's what this is. That's why DEI matters. Because it's about distribution of patronage. It's not about
client states.
Yes, right. It's not about production of excellence or research or something. It has to do with patronage. It's a system, and this is just our version of the Soviet Union. It's a system completely centered on political prerogatives and not on attainment of actual things.
Amen.
Right? So that's how we are going about cannibalizing ourselves.
So am I wrong to say all Marxism is populism? You know, like it is going to eat itself. It always does.
Our particular form of it, because of our democratic structure, sounds populist, or it is a left-wing version of populism. It's Marxism is a particular version of a focus not on what is objectively achievable, but on patronage to groups. So this version is somewhat Marxist, but it has the flavor that it does, which is announced in terms of kindness and justice, because we are not a historically Marxist society. Mm-hmm. That's why it's presented the way that it is, or that's why you have to get this kind of, you know, AI socialist realism where like a black person with red hair in a wheelchair is somehow doing surgery on like an elderly Hispanic woman. You know what I mean?
Gene Roddenberry foresaw it all.
Yeah, know? Right, right, right. It has that particular shape because of our non-Marxist and, you know, history, right? Hmm. This relates to the construction workers in this way, is that the thing about reality is that at least it's always there. And whatever is going on with our regime, with who is supposed to get a job to do open heart surgery on me, whether he's qualified or not, for the job, is that reality means that the construction industry is just absurdly, if I were upset about this, I would say disproportionately male. Men have to go on moving heavy stuff around, whether we want to or not. That's who does that job. And then men have to go on having to make a split second choice to say, you know what? Objectively, it would be better if this, you know, this woman going to work who has two little kids doesn't die. So I have to stop her car so that she doesn't die and I might die. We have to go on sacrificing for people, even if our being male was not useful to anybody up until those last, you know, 30 minutes of our life. But the reality is sitting there, even if we don't want to acknowledge it, or even if we have been taught that we should be angry about that reality, or even if when I applied for that construction job, guess what? Guess what the website showed me? It only showed me women smiling in hard hats. But then I got to the actual job and there were no women in hard hats, except when the architects visited. Otherwise, the reality was very different than what I was presented with by HR. And the reality in the moment was that I had to sacrifice myself, whatever it was that I was told this job was about, or whatever I was told about who was doing it. So, you know, the guy that stopped traffic, or the guys that stopped traffic, they accepted that they might die so that other people wouldn't have to, you know. And that is a beautiful reality of men being able to make split second decisions, particularly when other people's lives are in danger. That is a very beautiful thing. I don't know that any of this was particularly intentional. I think the idea that somehow that incompetence is on purpose, you know, I don't know.
Well, I think if I were a foreign power and I wanted to slowly destroy a country over time by attacking their education system so that their people eventually just become stupid and destroy themselves,
right?
Seems like a better course of war. If I've got 100 years to do it, you know, and I've got a civilization that thinks in those kinds of terms, which we don't, but everyone else does. I guess I would do everything I could to stop good information from getting into their hands and let them eat themselves over their stupidity. I'd foster it though. So like the idea that Russian bots are involved in American culture, I mean, duh, you know, and that China is sitting here selling us what to, I mean, is it just our own country that hates us? You really think it's just our own country? You know, so, you know, I think incompetence is on purpose in the sense of it's a tactic of the,
right,
of the bourgeois to keep the proletariat down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who was sailing what if I remember correctly, was a Singapore flagged ship contracted by a Danish shipping line. You know, crews are very often wildly polyglot.
Yeah.
And just to use the word again, disproportionately Filipino very often. That's still a sailing nation. But I don't, you know, whoever it was, they lose power in a situation and at a place where this could be completely disastrous. That's where I think the question of incompetence comes in. If it makes anyone feel better, disasters of incompetence have always been going on. That's different from the current narrative about incompetence, which is that we are losing competence. I certainly believe that in the sense of, and this is not a news story, but I read it at least a year ago. It was just a story about small manufacturing in Rockford, Illinois. And the question is, when, you know, Gary, a name nobody under a certain age has, retires, and he knows how to run this machine and that machine and the other machine, the competence question is, does anybody know how to replace Gary?
That's right.
That's real. I think on a wider level, that's what it's about. Regardless of whether Pete Buttigieg is going to get the Francis Scott Key Bridge fixed quickly, they tend to respond faster the more people there are.
I think you're going to see the incompetence on display as they try to rebuild this thing. I really do. I mean, I know they're going to throw money at it, and I hope it gets up for the sake of the area. My prayers couldn't be more with the people who are going to try to fix it. But I think that the problem with incompetence, how does this tanker go powerless here? It's not just the tanker. It's everybody involved in the entire operating system that they're not looking at the details because they're too busy looking at their phones. And the whole place is losing its mind. So these things are bound to happen. Yeah. Someone called this a black swan. I'm like, if you think this is a black swan, I'm worried about it. It's going to get much worse then, right?
You're like, that swan is white.
Yes.
Yeah. No, yeah. When the thing happened with East Palestine, the derailment happened, the guy that I talked to, we always have at least one listener who knows everything about this and has for years. So if you are
grateful
that listener,
for you, always,
if
always
you are that listener on, you know, bridges in Baltimore or the shipping industry, please get in touch. The guy who got in touch with me about East Palestine was basically like, I'm surprised this didn't happen much earlier, or it hasn't happened more often. Because come to find out, vinyl chloride gets spilled all over America all the time. So maybe in a way, it's actually worse than you thought. But when you have a spectacular problem, it's because you had low level ascending to maybe gradually, maybe very quickly, ascending to high level or high consequence incompetence for a long time. It's generally not, and this is, I think, the problem that we often see, is that when they don't want you to think much about incompetence or human agency, they'll make it seem, in the way that the story is told, that this is a black swan event. It's sort of like it's like a Category 5 hurricane hitting somewhere that Category 5 hurricanes almost never do. And so there's just not a lot you can do about it, right? Is that people will get treated like natural disasters when responsibility or competence is not something that you're supposed to be thinking about. When it is something you're supposed to be thinking about, there will be way too much agency attributed, okay? Because they want you to pile on guilt or responsibility to whoever it was so that it can be deflected from whoever else. In this case, my guess would be incredible amounts of low-level incompetence ascending more or less rapidly to high-level incompetence that says, at this crucial moment where I could destroy a lot of stuff instead of just this ship, the power goes out. The power goes out. Because that's a really, I mean, like takeoff and landing in aviation, embarking and reaching port are some of the trickiest times, as you know, if you've ever even used a rowboat. Those are the trickiest times. When you're out in the middle of the water, the consequences are relatively low. So the incompetence at that moment is, I think, the question. And I don't know enough as we record this days later, a couple days later. But I think that we will probably come to find out, and the listener who knows everything about the shipping industry will be able to tell us, that there was a lot of incompetence ascending now to a mm-hmm. giant problem.
Yeah, compounding.
Right.
Compounding.
Right.
The FBI probably did compound the conspiracy when they came out like 2 hours later and said they knew it wasn't anybody except incompetence.
Yeah.
They could have had anybody else say it.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, bring Pete Buttigieg out. Nobody even knows how to say his name, you know, because America is racist against Maltese people more than any.
It's Buttigieg.
Yeah. Right. It's Mayor Pete. You know, they could have had the transportation secretary come out and treat it as a transportation problem. But, I mean, and maybe it's just a PR failure, or maybe there's something worse going on. But don't bring the FBI out to be like, I know that the Russians didn't blow up the tankers in East Palestine. I know that the Chinese had nothing to do with this ship running into a bridge. You know, like, don't do it that way. And it does seem that of all things that are making for not only anger, but just dissolution of all kinds of social bonds, is the incapacity to even be convincing in the narrative that you're presenting. Like when I see people like that, I watch a video, whatever, I think you really are not good at this. Like, I wouldn't even trust you to advertise my Easter breakfast at church. I wouldn't, because you suck at being convincing in anything that you're saying. You just come off as weird, right? So it's also like, and this is how I think about Jonathan, is at this point, it doesn't even need to be shady.
No.
Because the effect of something being actually suspect or something looking suspect on the public is identical. It's not like the public is all going to go on the internet and figure out what really happened. And because it doesn't matter what really happened. What matters when you're talking about authority is whether there's any credibility.
Correct.
Credibility matters far more actually than what you're saying. You know, that's just the way it is, right? Your ethos in rhetoric matters a lot more than your logos. Whether it should or not, that's how people are built. Whether you're credible. And so it doesn't actually matter if the FBI is shady at all regarding the Francis Scott Key Bridge. What matters is that they come out 2 hours later and say, nothing to see. And I'm like, okay, why are you talking?
Men in Black, don't look at us. It's yeah, just show amazing. Me.
I want to talk to Mayor Pete, you know? And this even happened. I mean, I was listening to NPR because I hate myself. And on All Things Considered, right, their flagship program, the anchor sounded skeptical talking to the mayor of Baltimore, because she was like, is this going to be a matter of days, a matter of weeks? And he's like, it's going to take as long as it's going to take.
Like, oh, man.
Don't say it that way. I can't believe you've been elected to public office. Don't say it that way, you idiot. So this is, I mean, the fact
that he just
that,
looks stunned, and all the stuff I've seen of him, he just
exactly.
looks stunned. He's
the
not
capacity to carry a narrative is we don't, that's a competency crisis in leadership, because if you can't carry a narrative, convincingly for the people that you're an authority over, you won't be an authority very long.
You're listening to A Brief History of Power. You know where to find us or you would not be here.
What do you think of when you hear the word college? Expensive? Liberal? Woke? Imagine a college that is affordable. A college that is unapologetically conservative and Lutheran. A college that won't take a dime of federal funding. A college that teaches the best of our Western heritage. A college where students grow in the Christian faith instead of leaving it behind. This is Luther Classical College. A college by Lutherans and for Lutherans. Visit our website, lutherclassical.org, subscribe, become a patron, and join the thousands who are making Luther Classical College a reality.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small-town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, Historic Christian Orthodoxy, the Evangelical Lutheran Faith, in the beautiful Inland Northwest.